So welcome to the next interview, podcast or YouTube, depending on where you are at the moment, with Corey Fahrenkopf. Have you said it right?
Fahrenkopf? Sure. I mean, you're from Germany. You probably pronounce it better than I do.
Yeah, we would say Fahrenkopf.
So then it's we'll go with that. German.
Yeah, okay. And I have read a short story collection, Haunted Ecology, and a novel, Living in Cemeteries, and reviewed both, and then asked him, would you like to join me for an interview speaking about horror and what horror should do or shouldn't, or how to write, how to read, how to have fun, or a much more interesting life with horror? Would you like to introduce yourself first, Steve?
Sure, yeah. So I'm Corey Fahrenkopf. I am a writer and librarian. I live on Cape Cod, which is the, for those of you who aren't around here, it's the little arm that sticks off of Massachusetts. So we're this peninsula that's like in the middle of the ocean, and it creates a very interesting landscape and a very interesting kind of lifestyle that you end up having. Yeah, I published two books so far. I've got the short story collection, Haunted Ecologies, the novel, Living in Cemeteries. I published over 100 short stories at this point. A lot of it is horror or dark fantasy or dark sci-fi or like literary, weird, surreal, between genre kind of stuff. That's me. Yeah.
And after having read a couple of stories of yours, I am under the impression that we share a value about horror, which is there's nothing spooky if it's only about the spooky thing. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I like to think that the horror that I write is more subtle in certain ways. Like, I'm not like a jump scare kind of guy. I'm not a guy who's like, all of a sudden the serial killer pops up and he's got the machete and there's blood everywhere. Ah. I like trying to do like more of a quiet build to things. My favorite type of horror usually deals with like the unknown, with uncertainty, with like ambiguity, or uses horror as a metaphor for something else. I always have a kind of like this weird in-between phase that I exist in where like I think a lot of what I do that I sometimes consider horror might actually be dark fantasy, because a lot of what I do is not written with the intent to scare you. It's got lots of like macabre trappings and it's got lots of like spooky elements to it. But at the end of the day, most of the time, I'm not trying to be like, whoa, make you feel terror in your chest.
It seems to be about the human beings first. And I, as a reader, engage with the human beings and their situations. And when I have this engagement with the characters in your story, I want all the best for them usually. And then something goes really bad, or sometimes not really bad, but bad in some subtle way. It depends on the story. And I don't really want that, but I can't stop reading and hoping it will turn out okay-ish. Sometimes it doesn't. But it's not the everybody's dead in the end horror, which is really boring. Yeah. I would like to give an example for the listeners who might not know a story of yours. Would you mind to talk about The Burn Floor a little bit more in detail? Because that's a pretty short story and we might be able to summarize it a little bit.
Yeah, I could talk about The Burn Floor. So I wrote that like 5 years ago, maybe. My memory of like when I wrote a thing and published a thing is more wishy-washy than it should be. But it got published originally in the Florida Review. It's about a family who goes to whose whole goal is to like make this magical experience for their kids, to bring them to this amusement park that may or may not be modeled off of a famous amusement park in Florida. But legally, I probably can't say which one it is. And they don't have a lot of money. They're both very working class people. And this is set slightly in the future where like our economic struggles have gotten worse and worse. And it's very hard to afford to take your family on these kind of trips and to get a hotel room and to just like provide all the things you want to do for a child at a certain age. Cause like there's supposed to be magic in that, right? You're supposed to do the things to have the kids have the memories that they're supposed to have, quote unquote. So the family, they try really hard to save up enough money, but they can only get enough money to afford the burnt floor on this hotel. So it's like a 5-star hotel, but there was a fire that ravaged the whole first or the whole top floor where everything's burnt black, but it's really cheap to get a room there. The only thing is you have to wear like a respirator the whole time you're there. If you're breathing the air, it's carcinogenic. It really raises the potential of you getting wicked sick. And so the parents are like, this is the only way we can do it. So we're gonna do it. And it may lead to bad things for them. Or maybe it doesn't. I don't know. I mean, I do know. I read it, but I wrote it. But that's kind of the summary of it. And it was me trying to look at the pressures that a lot of people feel in order to provide like these things that, I guess in America for the most part, like, there's a number of people who'd be like, you need to take your kid to this place at this age, or you need to be able to do this for this person in your life. You need to be able to spend this amount of money on Christmas presents. You need to be able to buy them this brand of this so that they can feel accepted by their classmates or whatever. There's all these expectations, and all of it requires lots of money. And the farther and farther we get along in time, it's becoming harder and harder to do that for people. And there's lots of people who like feel they like need to do this, that are being bad parents, you know, and it's very unfortunate because it puts a lot of stress on people, and people do not deserve to have as much stress on them as they do these days.
Yeah, I think I would like to have this story as an example as well, because I know that this YouTube channel and podcast is also followed by Science Fiction fans, and this is like a crossover between science fiction and horror. It's very much dystopian. It's a little bit like evil climate fiction. It's not going well. And I think it's even more a dystopia than a horror story, which which is understandable because the title of the story collection is Haunted Ecology. So it's a lot about climate as well and a world which isn't like ours anymore. And I really liked the first sentence, like, Bronski and Janet saved for 3 years, but could only afford a room on the burnt floor. We know so much about the story and Bronski and Janet after the sentence, but we also have so many questions. You surely cannot put down the story after this sentence. This will lead to the second and to the third, you know, because why is this floor even burned? And why? Okay, I know they are poor. They had to save for, but if you have to save 3 years for one holiday, okay, yeah, that's a long time. I think most families save maybe 1 year or so, because we have one big vacation per year, maybe an average. I don't really know about the USA. I think here it's, yeah, maybe, but well, and it's really bad because as a mother myself, I feel bad for the family. They are desperately trying to make some good experiences and memories, and yes,
yeah,
have to struggle with their head. And what I also learned about you as an author when I read the story collection, there are some perspectives which I am pretty sure you have not experienced yourself, like being a single woman, trying to find nice dates. This might be far from your usual life. Do you enjoy to wife the other?
Yeah. And I, if I'm being honest, like for the most part, when I write, I don't really choose who my characters are. They kind of just like are in the story and just exist. Like I can try to like change them to fit a thing, but usually like the story comes to me with the character already in it doing its kind of thing. The story where you're talking about the single woman trying to get dates, that's just kind of like a female version of me back when I was living out in Western Mass, having horrible dating experience. And I try to, whenever I do something like that, I'm not really trying to write it like a bigger picture kind of thing. Like when with that character in Growth Decay, I'm not trying to do a commentary on what it's like to be a single woman. I'm trying to do a story where there's a single woman in it and she's going through the thing. She's going through the plot. Because I'm a big supporter of the idea of not trying to write like the big thematic things that you are not necessarily connected with, if that makes sense. You know? And trying to do it in like the most respectful way if possible. But yeah, like when I write those stories, like she was just the character that was going to be there. And I have to follow her through as she goes through the things. And her voice is the voice that's like in the back of my head in some way. And a lot of what I do is not plotted for the most part. I'm doing a lot of pantsing, as they say. So a lot of that is just me following along with the character and be like, I wonder what's going to happen to him. And in that one, like, things get weird, as they always get weird.
Well, you don't necessarily know the ending.
Not usually. I'm trying to go through all the stories in the collection. And I would say like at least 90% of them, I did not know the ending. I usually like write my way to it. Because like there's so many writers who talk about it in the sense of when you are surprised by the ending, your reader will be surprised by the ending. And sometimes if you know the ending already, you forecast it too much and people can see it coming. It takes away a lot of the shock. It takes away a lot of the... I guess the propelling force, if that makes sense. So I try to keep as much suspense there by me having no idea what's going on. But also in some writerly way, it puts less pressure on you in the beginning, at least to be, cause you're not feeling like, oh my God, I need to hit all these notes. I need to hit all these beats. And then in order to make the ending happen, you just write it through, see the ending and then realize like, hey, okay, this needs like two more beats and two more little bits of foreshadowing here and there. And you can go back and like seed that throughout, as opposed to having to like have it all planned out beforehand. And that's generally how I do it. I get to the end. I realize the ending works this way. And in order for it to fully work that way, I have to go back and put like one or two building blocks along the way to make the whole thing like equal what people want.
Did you know the ending of Living in Cemeteries? Or at least the main twist, you might know what I'm hinting at.
Yeah, I think so. I might be lying, though. I wrote Living in Cemeteries like 12 years ago or something like that. It was when I graduated college, I was working as a cemetery landscaper on Cape Cod, well, between going to school and job hunting and stuff. And I would go and mow the lawns during the day, and then I would come home at night and I would write 1,000 words, 1,500 words. And I think I might have had a vague idea of where I was going, but for the most part, then I plotted nothing. Like I plot more now than I used to, but then I used to just like write my 1,000 words and it would get where it's going. And back then I was really young and didn't really know as much as I do now. So the original version of Living in Cemeteries needed an insane amount of editing, an insane amount of rewriting, an insane amount of just like taking out full chapters to make a more propellant or a more propulsive chapter or something that isn't just two characters sitting on a couch talking about their emotions. But I feel like with Living in Cemeteries, I had an idea of like four or five of the later beats. I think I knew that at some point one thing was going to happen or another thing was going to happen. So I'd have to write towards those. But I think I had a very gray idea of what those were going to be. Yeah.
That character felt more like a similar situation in life as you might have had 12 years ago, a young man working at the cemetery, having a girlfriend who is really serious about maybe the first one. The first serious one, I mean, living in a shared flat with an interesting flatmate.
Yeah.
Good, something's that. But the main thing for the listeners who don't know Living in Cemeteries, that people in that world, it has a lot of world building. It's horror, but it has a lot of fantastical world building because usually, you know when you will die and how? Not necessarily, but usually. So this is also a topic often addressed in science fiction, and there are some great novels about it. And I couldn't, there's one scene with two sisters, and the one knows, okay, I might die within this year. And the other one knows, I will live into my 80s. And so the one who has fear for her life tells her sister, you have no idea. You have no idea what I'm going through. And yes, that's true, isn't it? You can't have any idea if you're not in that situation. And in our world, you're only in this situation if you have a terminal illness, because usually you don't know. And this might influence your life a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And adapt in your novel a lot for some, yeah. For many, many characters. So is this what you wanted to achieve with your novel, to think about, well, what if we know?
Yeah, I mean, there's kind of like two prongs of that story or of that novel, like the major things I'm looking at. And a lot of it is like, what does it mean to live a good life, quote unquote? I always have to caveat this with, I went to Catholic school for like 9 years, and I spent a lot of time thinking about morality and being a good person and like, what does it mean to be a good person and how does one achieve that? I'm not religious at the moment or anything like that. So this is kind of like a thing I carry with me anyway. Like, I very much care about being a good person and trying to encourage other people to be good people. So that was one of the things. And then the other thing was like, I guess there's two other things, but the idea of living your life to the fullest, the idea of living your life for your joy, for your self-fulfillment, for just doing the things you want to do. How do you achieve that? How do you live for yourself versus how do you see your life if you're living for someone else or trying to make someone else happy? I have a good amount of anxiety in my life. So this is the thing I'm always thinking about, because it's like, oh, I want to do this thing, but like, maybe I'm nervous about it. Or maybe I think someone's going to think a certain thing about me if I do it that way. Or like a thousand other things, and your mind just kind of unspools and just runs for a long time. And then you miss out on so many things. You don't let yourself do a thing that might just be fun and is not harmful to anyone and is just like a positive thing. But because you spend so much time agonizing over it, it either ruins it in your mind, or the opportunity has passed you by, or like the concert's over. You can't go to the concert when the concert's already been happening. So a lot of that, I think now that I've talked about this novel for a long time, I think a lot of it was just like a message to myself, trying to get me to break a lot of my habits where I just would get too nervous and like not do stuff and not live my life the way I want to, or not live my life to the fullest or whatever. So it's a combination of those two things. And the third thing is kind of a thing I think is strange with humans, where I think we can all clearly see through history and through like advances in science that everything we do has impacts on the world. And a lot of the things we've done have been really bad, whether it's like historical, like wars and like genocides and terrible stuff, or it's climate change and it's despeciation. And it always blows my mind that a lot of people like don't care and don't think about how the way they live their lives have repercussions on the future generations. So a lot of the book was me looking at how one character's good and bad decisions affect their future relatives, right? Because that's, I don't have children. I don't really plan on having children. But if I did the whole time I had children, this is probably why I don't have them, because I'd be worrying all the time. Is how what am I doing, and how is it setting them up for success? How is it making the world they're going to live in worse? Is something I'm going to do going to create catastrophe for them later? And so my book takes that as like a very direct example. Because like the first chapter, you meet Clay, who is the main character's best friend. He's related to a matador who killed like 100 bulls or something. And it's like a commentary on killing animals for sport. Like, I'm not a vegetarian. I like completely understand eating meat and stuff like that, but I don't understand killing things for the sake of killing things, for the sake of spectacle. And so he is connected to that uncle. And because of that, he dies very young by a bunch of spirits bringing a bull to a family reunion, and then he gets gored. Sorry for the spoiler. That's on page 3. So it's me trying to make a very direct way of pointing out, like, hey, the things that we do, the decisions that we make in our lives affect those that come after us. And like, maybe we should be a little more just concerned about the things we're doing. And maybe it'll encourage people to like live a better life. But I don't know. I don't know how much moral training or moral guidance people get out of fiction these days. And I'm like pretty, a lot of what I write has pretty strong and in-your-face morals in them. And I feel like I've been told that's not a great way to write, but like that's just what comes out of me. So, yeah.
And it's just, one author I interviewed said that fiction should open wounds. And mm-hmm. I think as long as you open wounds with your prose and don't make it too narrow for me as a reader, then you are allowed to do whatever you want to do. So it surely isn't too narrow, because I took other things from that novel than the mm-hmm. ones you just mentioned. And obviously it wasn't too narrow for me to have my own morals out of the novel. Mm-hmm. What seems to be the main difference between US American authors and German authors? You seem to have a lot of more opportunity to learn how to write really well from early on. I thought about it this week in preparation, and I think we stopped writing for good when we were 13 or so at school. And everything we did until that point was like basic stuff. So we didn't really learn how to write well in our school or university. At least I didn't. And many people I talked to didn't either. And I know you mentioned that in other interviews, and other authors mentioned that as well. You learn a lot more, do you?
Let's see. So yeah, I mean, as a kid, I read a lot. Like, that was like my sanctuary. I'd read lots of fantasy novels. I would just like curl up on the couch at my parents' house and like stay away from the world and read my books, because I had lots of anxiety and that's how I dealt with it. But we had creative writing classes, or there's always a part of your regular English class or literature class that would be on creative writing. Sometimes it'd be a couple weeks, sometimes it'd be a month. I remember in seventh grade, our teacher assigned us to write a story. And I was like, I'm going to write a novel, because I was really into reading novels. And I was like, I can do it. And so I had like one of those black and white composition notebooks. And I just would just write and just go and go and go and go. No editing, none of that. Because like, it was not a computer. It would have been terrible to edit the thing. And I didn't finish it by the time it was supposed to be finished. I showed up we had this night where all the parents came in and all the kids were going to read their stories, and a lot of kids would write a story about like being a ballerina or like making cupcakes. One of my best friends, Mark, just copied the back of a Stephen King novel and just like read it like he had written it, and everyone's like, wow, you're an amazing writer, you're so talented. And Mark was like, yeah, I am. And then
which one?
It was something like I'm Not Martin or something. It was about like a kid whose face gets taken off and given to another kid, and he gets another person's face on it. And it might have been a Stephen King short story or something, but I think that's what it was. But then eventually like I had to get up and read my thing, and I've got this 30, 40, 50 page novel about dragons and elves killing goblins. And again, I'm in Catholic school, so there's like nuns in the room. There's like all the parents of my classmates who were all in Catholic school, right? And so I'm writing this thing, and the first lines are something like, and the elf drew back his bow and let fly the arrow, and it speared the goblin through the eyeball, and a trail of gore and innards flew out on the tree and coated everything in blood. And it went on for a while like that. And everyone in the class, or a lot of people in the class, are looking at me like, oh my god, this kid is insane. We should be watching this boy. And then I felt really bad about it. So after that, I stopped writing for a long time.
Oh, that's so bad.
Yeah, it is. But in high school, I did a bunch of creative writing classes. I had a teacher named Lisa Doyle, who was amazing. She was very into just being a big champion of creativity in all of its forms. Just being like, write the thing you want, write weird stuff. I'll give you some scaffolding. I'll give you some background. I will show you some examples, but like, you do you. Like, and that was something I think like everyone needs, is just like the time to develop what they want to do creatively, whether it's with writing or music or art. And just to not, to have very, like a very wide avenue you can go down, right? She wasn't strict. She wasn't like, you have to do this exact thing. She's like, here's all the space, play, go crazy. So that was high school. In college, I specialized in creative writing. So in the English track at UMass Amherst, you can just be a regular English major. You can be an English major with a creative writing specialization, or you can be an English major with a technical writing specialization, which is people who like edit textbooks or do work for corporations that are like writing copy and things of that nature. It's the part of the English job that like pays really well. And in some ways, I'm always like, man, I could have done that and be making good money. So I did four years of that, which a lot of it is doing Creative Writing 101, then Creative Writing 201. And that, again, was a lot of exposure to just a wide variety of writers. UMass really liked experimental surrealist writers. So I got exposed to like a lot of cool stuff. We read like Joy Williams also, and Dennis Johnson, and mostly literary stuff. So it wasn't a lot of sci-fi, fantasy, horror, which is sad, but that's just how it is sometimes. I eventually took a capstone writing class, which is a year-long intensive where at the end, you have to produce like a capstone project. And a lot of people would do short story collections. I, again, was like, I'm going to write a novel, because I viewed a lot of my writing as, or my writing education as like education in a trade of sorts, as being like, this is what you need to develop these muscles and these skills in order to do this job, right? And I was like, I can write short stories. Like, you can just pump one of those out, write 10 pages. But in order to write a novel, there's like a lot of effort that goes behind it. There's a lot of scaffolding. There's a lot of like deep dive background stuff you have to do. And I don't have those skills. And like, this is the time I'm going to get to learn those skills. So I use that whole year as just like learning how to put that many words on a page, how to think about stuff divided by chapters, how to learn about the beats in a novel, how to do all that kind of stuff. And at one point, my professor pulled me aside and was like, Corey, like, I let you in this class for like certain reasons, that, because you're like a good writer, but like this novel, man, it's not great. Like, you gotta, I expect more out of you. You need to like pull it together and do it. And in the moment, I was like, oh my God, I am so hurt. This is so sad. I am working my hardest. But in the end, it like really pushed me to get better and to like go even farther, to be even more clear with my writing, to just like give it everything I could. And I look back at that moment as like one of the big changing. Like, it was just a big moment in my life where I was like, man, if I'm going to do this, I have to like not be lazy. I have to not pull any punches. I have to just go where I need to go with it. So I did that. And that was all my formal training. Since then, I go to a lot of writing workshops, a lot of writing conferences. Like, I go to ReaderCon every year. And at that, people are always talking about just different writing ideas for like science fiction and fantasy and horror. And I always come away with like a bunch of new ideas of like, oh, I want to write a story that plays with this trope, or a story that uses this unusual form. Like, I wrote a choose your own adventure haunted house story after listening to like Sarah Pinsker talk about interactive fiction. And that's kind of how I continue it these days. I am always trying to learn more and trying to get inspired and trying to think of stories and fiction in ways that I haven't before. Because like, if I'm not challenging myself all the time, your brain goes in those ruts where it's like, it's comfortable writing this kind of story, it's comfortable writing that kind of story. But going to these workshops and like watching online talks and stuff, it gets you thinking about like the grooves that your brain doesn't travel down. And that is a long-winded way of explaining I have done a bit of writing training.
No, that's it. Exactly what I was aiming at. No worries. Because, well, I hope we will go there one day, because sometimes I think it's all Goethe's fault. You know, this guy who's already dead since a couple of hundred years and who was a genius and who wrote all this stuff. But I'm pretty sure he really puts his life in it. And now everybody, almost everybody, seems to think, oh, I'm a genius. I can just write and it will be great. Yeah. And I don't have to practice it because it was Goethe, you know? We had Goethe and the USA didn't have Goethe, but all the authors who really worked on their writing for I don't know how many years before they got famous. Like Stephen King.
Yeah.
Paul Auster, I don't know who else. for 10 years or so, I seem to have but only these two authors and nobody else. But since 5 years or so, I read so many authors. Even Sarah Pinsky, who mentioned her just a minute ago, I read her story collection. But I haven't read the last novel yet. Have you?
Good. Yeah, yeah.
Maybe. Yeah.
Yeah, she does a cool thing where that story also kind of lives in a similar vein as my stuff does, because I don't think Sarah Pinsker's stuff is usually meant to scare you. It's usually, I feel like it's meant to unnerve you. It's meant to have you walk through some place that's got like a really dark, strange, off, uncanny atmosphere. And that one's about a woman who goes to work on a film set where people, for a TV show where the TV show basically fakes hauntings in home renovations or for home renovation shows. And it's got like a lot of cool commentary on like reality TV and the idea of like old haunted places. But it's like a very quiet horror story, and there's like some very beautiful, gentle moments in it. I'm a huge Sarah Pinsker fan. The collection you read, was it the one that has Two Truths and a Lie in it and Where Oaken Hearts Do Gather?
Yes, and Two Truths and a Lie I already read before. And it was really a short novelette, or I don't really know. Like short, larger than just a short story, but shorter than a novel. And I would like that, but the ending was pretty weird, but I still like that story. Yes, I think I even bought the story collection. There was no ebook, only print, and I had to order it from the USA. And it was really complicated.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's not your fault. Blame it on Sarah Pinsker or her publishing house, maybe. But now it's on. I've read it. It's on my, you know, one of my few prints I have these days. But I have the new ebook, and I haven't read it yet. So there's always too much to read.
There is.
I think the novel you just described, Home Sweet Home. Yeah. I haven't read that yet. It's still there.
It's good.
Waiting for me. Yeah. So do you read a lot of contemporary horror authors from USA or Great Britain, or who else is publishing in English?
Yeah, I mean, I read a lot, I also read very slowly, which is kind of a curse for a person who has like a billion books on his to be read list. I'm like a snail; it's kind of painful. But yeah, no, I read a ton. I also run a science fiction, fantasy, horror book group at my library, so I'm always trying to give people like diverse options for that. I run a short story, sci-fi, fantasy, or short story group at the library, so we're always making our way through. We just get copies of the year's best American science fiction and fantasy that like John Joseph Adams edits, and so we read those. So I'm pretty up on that. But yeah, no, I try to read pretty broadly between sci-fi, fantasy, horror. I don't read a lot of lit fic anymore. I do if it deals with the uncanny or is speculative or is just weird. I don't read a lot of stuff that doesn't have some element of that in it. I think it's partially because like the world I exist in my writing life is I do speculative, uncanny stuff. And there's already so much of that. And if I like don't know what other people are writing, I don't know where I fit into that landscape. And I always think it's really important to know where you exist there. So yeah, like I mean, I also read a good amount of stuff for blurbs these days. So I'm always reading some of my contemporary stuff to provide them blurbs so that hopefully it gets them some more notice or something. But yeah, no, I love, really, I love between genre work. So like I said, like Sarah Pinsker's work has been like really influential to me. I really love A.C. Wise's work, her collection, The Ghost Sequences, right? Or Ghost Variations? Ghost Sequences. I think that's like a perfect collection because they're all ghost stories, but they're ghost stories that go in so many different directions. Like there's one in there called the Nag Bride, and it's a folklore ghost story about like a haunted barn and this like weird equestrian folklore. And it's so dark and so beautifully written. And then she's got one in there called like Exhalation number 7 or number 9. I wish I had it right in front of me so I could just tell you. And that's like a detective story about someone trying to figure out this person who's like recording snuff films. And it's so dark, but it's so beautifully written. And it was in like a bunch of years back. So I look at those, like her stuff as like a big thing for me. Nathan Ballingrid, he was also like a very intense guiding light for a lot of what I do. If you read Wounds, like the last story in it is like a cosmic horror pirate story. So it's like if Pirates of the Caribbean was about people trying to go to hell to have a conversation with the devil to try to like earn a lot of favors, if one would say. But then there's like a really like sweet story in there about this like town that's kind of in hell where there's like kids that play like this game and there's like all these traditions and there's like a festival going on. And it just hits, there's so many different points of that collection that are just like all over the place for range, but it all just fits beautifully together. I really love what Kelly Link is doing. I really love what Karen Russell is doing. Karen Russell has a new novel out that I haven't read yet that I'm just like so insanely excited about. That one's called The Antidote. Really looking forward to that. I guess one of the stories I try to tell in the vein of this or whenever I'm talking about this is when I was younger, I read mostly genre fantasy. When I was in college, we didn't read a lot of speculative stuff. I'm told that a lot of college writing programs don't really look at genre in the same way as they're not as open about it sometimes. I know that today there are a lot more places that are incorporating more sci-fi and more fantasy and more horror. But 10 to 15 years ago when I was in school, it wasn't as much that way. So a lot of what I've come across in reading in the early days before I was like a full-time librarian was just me randomly discovering stuff. Like I lived in Western Mass, and that's where Kelly Link lives. That's where her publishing company is with Gavin Grant. So the library just had tons of Kelly Link stuff, had tons of stuff that her publishing house would put out, would have tons of stuff that was kind of next to it, like in the genre world. So I would just like go in and pull out random books that had like cool titles and cool covers. And that's how I found Nathan Ballingrid's North American Lake Monsters. But I read a lot of Year's Best dark fantasy and sci-fi and all those big anthologies. And so that's how I discovered a lot of the writers who I love now. Like that would kind of act as a roadmap for me where I would purposely take out these anthologies or Jeff and Ann Vandermeer's The Weird Compendium or when Michael Kelly was doing Year's Best Weird. I would go in and find these writers and figure out what stories resonate with me. And then I would kind of trace their lineage and figure out like what they're writing, what their other books are, who influenced them. Because I think it's taken me a long time to figure out what I wanted to do as a writer and who I want to be as a writer. And like there was a moment where I had just started reading. I've been reading Karen Russell and Kelly Link and Nathan's work. And then I discovered Jeff Vandermeer's work and Paul Tremblay's work at about the same time. And I just picked them up. I picked up Annihilation because it had a really cool cover. And I was like, look at this cover. This is crazy. Love it. And I picked up Paul Tremblay's book because A Head Full of Ghosts. I'm like, that's an awesome title. So I read both of those and I was like, the combination of this is where I want to go. Just in the same way when I read Karen Russell and Kelly Link pretty early on, I was like, wow, this is what I want to do. So I've got all these like different writers who kind of live in my head and I want to be somewhere between all of them. You know, like I'm not trying to riff on them. I'm not trying to copy them, but I'm trying to be like, this is what they do. This is what they're trying to say. These are the elements they use. This is the atmosphere. This is just all the different parts of their stories. And I want to be associated with those writers. I want to have my stuff be of a similar quality and in a similar vein. Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool. So you know exactly what you want to achieve.
Yeah, I mean, I hope so.
Yeah. Can you remember the first book that really left an impression on you, like reading the book and then thinking, oh, wow, that's possible as well?
Yeah. Like I said, I mean, Annihilation and Head Full of Ghosts both did something like that for me. But probably the oldest one, I'm thinking of two short stories. So Karen Russell has a short story collection called St. Lucy's Home for Girls Raised by Wolves. And the title story of that, St. Lucy's Home for Girls Raised by Wolves, it's about like a nunnery that basically takes girls in who are feral, who basically parents abandoned them and they got raised by wolves. And they're teaching them how to be like functional members of society. And it's so insanely beautifully written. And it's so sad. And there's so many like beautiful moments in it. And I was just like, my God, this is a perfect story. It's crushing. And it's so weird. You know, it's a bunch of nuns like trying to get like a bunch of these like 12-year-old girls to stop like biting each other. It's just hilarious. So that one was a big, big moment for me. And the other one would be Kelly Link. I think it's called like The New Boyfriend or The Boyfriend. It's in her collection, Get in Trouble. And it's about this girl who's got a birthday party and her friend who comes over. And the friend is jealous because like the friend whose birthday party it is, she gets like all these really expensive toys. And the toys are like these life-size animatronic monsters that you put a little bit of your DNA under their tongue and they like love you and they follow you around and it's real creepy and weird. And I saw her read it at Odyssey Books out in Southampton, Massachusetts. And so she read it and I was like, oh my God, this is mind blowing. This is, again, like something adjacent to what I would like to do. Like I would like to write these like weird kind of heart-wrenching, occasionally like haunting, occasionally a little absurd sort of stories. And so I bought the collection because it was like one of her release tour stops, I think. And just like that was the first thing I read in it. And yeah, it was, that was pretty, pretty earth-shattering for me.
Yeah, obviously, I only have her new story collection, White Cat, Black Dog, and not the one you just mentioned. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Get in Trouble's great. White Cat, Black Dog is in my like top three favorite collections ever. Like, there's a story in there called White Road that is so perfect and hits like every note for me. So I, nothing but good things to say about that one.
So you already mentioned that you're always in the search of the uncanny when you're reading and when you're writing. So there's no vanilla, so non-fantastic of yours. Okay, yeah. I see you have understood what I meant because I'm usually asked what I mean. So so it has always been this. And thinking about your story collection, there's always seems to be something underneath, like the guy who wants to rescue that monster and has difficulties to prove that he didn't murder anybody and he's really afraid. If they put me in jail, who will take care of the monster then? You know, like really interesting human emotions. So Is the fantastic the horror a vehicle for you to really go under and examine how we humans work inside our head and our hearts, and why is this the way for you, or do you even know?
Yeah, that's a great question. How would I want to answer it? I mean, so that story specifically, we've been enough places to know. I think it's exactly what you're saying. Like, I use these weird monsters. I use these unusual situations to kind of get at different emotions that I have. Like, that's generally what I'm trying to do or trying to exhume. Because I always have this desire to help, this desire to fix things, this desire to just like make people's lives easier and more comfortable. And it's one of the, like the major driving forces for me. It's like at my library, I do a lot of programming around this sort of thing where I'm trying to like help people out and give people like a place to do what they want to do or a place to like be free and feel themselves and not feel like the world is like going to crush them in some way. So that story, like, is really about a guy who wants to help this thing that's looked at as a monster, but no one really knows if it's a monster. It's just like the sea creature. And you don't know if it's bad, but people put all these labels on things, being like, this thing's bad. We got to deal with it in some way. So I think that's me trying to examine, I kind of have like a white knight syndrome of sorts where I'm always trying to help people. My heart is always like, you need to be doing something. And with some of the problems that are going on in the world today, like I can't fix them. Like I can't fix climate change. I can't fix despeciation. I can do like little things that will like lead up to bigger things. But like myself, I can't go out like get a sword and like kill climate change, you know? So the monsters in a lot of my stories are representations of those things that can be dealt with. It with human means, you know, like that monster, the guy can like protect it. He can feed it. He can make sure it's safe and it can just live its life and exist. And hopefully it'll get to go on and like have a nice monster life, whatever the heck that looks like. Whereas like so much in my life, I can't actually do that. I can't make sure someone's life is like perfect and safe and all that kind of stuff. I can't make sure my life is perfect and safe. So through these stories, I'm able to use like horror to get at that. I also use it to get at like my abstract fears, you know, like fear of death. Like there's nothing you can do to conquer that. Like it just exists. You can be healthy and you can live a longer life because of that. But like you never know when it's coming for you, like you were saying earlier. So I think that's a lot of it. I guess another reason why I do it is just like, I find it really interesting. I find things that aren't real to be fascinating. I find folklore and religion and mythology to be strange. And just it draws me in and I'm like, what can I do with that? How can I make that my own thing? Like from a young age, I really liked Tim Burton's work and Guillermo del Toro's work. And they're always messing with the uncanny and the strange to some extent. And that's one of the things that also like has kind of guided me. And I guess I also just don't really like, I don't really write realist stuff because if I was going to do that, I would just like live my life more, you know, because like I could have weird dramatic experiences instead of like sitting at my desk and writing about weird, normal dramatic experiences. Like the sad thing that happened to me at the Stop and Shop, you know? Yeah, and I think that so much of my life has been flavored by the uncanny and by like supernatural stuff. Again, like I went to Catholic school, so that's years and years and years of me thinking about like some deity in the sky who is always casting judgment, who has all these like fingers and different things and can like have bad things happen to you if it feels like it. But also living on Cape Cod, like Cape Cod's, as far as the United States goes, is wicked old. Like we were settled in like the 1640s and 1630s. So there's lots of old history here and there's lots of like old buildings and like ghosts and folklore and stuff like that. So I think the combination of all that leads up to me not writing vanilla stuff. And it's what I want to read and it's what I want to see more of in the world. So it's what I do.
I have one next to last question.
Yeah.
So not the last one, but the next half. It was important for you to have a new innovative idea on the fantastical side because there's so much already there. Mm-hmm. And is it even possible to have a new idea or how important is it for you?
I think it's very important. This is like one of those things that like I think when I say it out loud it sounds cocky. But I always try to do stuff that no one else is doing or doing something in ways no one else is doing it. Like, I really don't like if my stories are directly in line with someone else's stories or you can clearly see the influence in them. So I'm always trying to think of more unique, more strange stuff. without being like gory and gross and like shock factory. Like, I don't do a lot of explicitly gory stuff, because like that's another way people do more unique stuff, is they make it shocking. They make it like really in your face. I like doing the more subtle stuff. And I think that's important. I think that most writers, or a lot of writers, that's like what you should be thinking about, is like, how is what you're going to create going to be different from all of your peers? Because you can write the normal haunted house story, and it can be written again and again and again, and people love them, and that's great. But how can you make your haunted house story different? And sometimes I think this like I shoot myself in the foot by doing this too, because there are a lot of readers who want the familiar, who want comfort, who want ground that's already been tread, because they're familiar with it, and it's nice to encounter the familiar. But with living in cemeteries, like, I was trying to do this thing that was between so many genres, that ideally was doing its own thing. And when we were submitting it to editors, like when my agent was sending it out, we kept getting this feedback of being like, hey, we love this. The writing's awesome. We like how weird it is, but like, we don't know how to sell this thing. It's between these genres. It's not literary enough to be literary, and it's not genre enough to be genre. So like, maybe if he rewrites it and leans more into the literary side of things, or maybe if he rewrites it and makes it more genre, it'll fit better in a category. But I did my best to like go back and give it more genre stuff, which I think was the right move. It's more fun that way. But it still had such a hard time coming out and getting into the world because of this. And most of my short stories follow a very similar thing, where they're usually too genre to be considered literary, and too literary sometimes to be considered genre by certain places. And in the genre world, a lot of people don't like talking about like literary sci-fi, literary horror, literary fantasy, or whatever. So we're not going to delve down that road. But yeah, so I've always found myself like really between things. And when I've tried to do more genre or tried to do something more literary, it just doesn't work. I kind of am forced to create the thing that I create. I don't really believe I have a lot of say in what I'm doing. My brain just kind of churns out what it's churning out. And I mean, that comes from all my influences, right? I read it. It's like what Matt Bell says, where he's like, good art in, good art out. So I'm constantly absorbing all of this stuff that I really enjoy and that I want to have somehow like percolating in the back of my brain. And then that's what I come up with. So yeah, and I'm always seeking writers who do that. Like a lot, almost all the writers who I named earlier are writers who are doing their own thing that I don't think is, like, you can see who their like literary forefathers are and stuff, but you would never read like one of A.C. Wise's stories and be like, oh, this is just like a reskin of like a Machen story or something like that. Machen? Arthur Machen? I never know how to pronounce his last name. And like the same thing with like Laird Barron's work. Like, I feel like Laird, his like first three collections are all cosmic horror, but they're not cosmic horror the way anyone else does cosmic horror. And I was really drawn to that. I was like, wow, this guy, like, I love cosmic horror. I love the weird atmosphere. I love the like unknowable darkness that it is. But I love the fact that his thing is just like doing its own thing. Yeah, I'm always on a quest for that. That's like one of my greatest joys is when I stumble on a new writer who is doing this sort of thing. And I'm like, oh my God, look at this. This is great. Like, Nadia Bolkin is another great example of this. Like, Nadia does her own thing. She does play with tropes in certain ways sometimes, where she'll take like an established idea and then like twist it, put it on its head, and just like make it weird. But she's got this new novella that came out called Red Skies and Morning, or Red Skies at Night. And I know the first printing of it sold out, but it's going to be coming out in this novella collection of hers from Ghoulish Books later this year, I think. And it's like, she's taking a lot of stuff out of contemporary horror, like The Ring, and then mixing it with like kind of cosmic horror, with like family drama, with sci-fi, like speculative future stuff. And it's just like this perfect combination of everything, and it just goes on like all cylinders the whole way through. The basic premise is there's like this disease that's passed to people through watching these found footage videos. And once you've viewed it, you get this like kind of thing that's following you around that will eventually kill you. But what you have to do is get someone else to watch that video to pass on that illness to someone else, and then you are free and don't have to worry about the thing killing you. but it's about a company who does this for people. So they're constantly passing around these illnesses. And like, what if no one shows up to volunteer to like take your illness that day? And it's such a complex premise and it's so beautifully written. And like, God, it'll be great when that's out again with the other novellas so that like everyone can read it, because it's just crushingly beautiful.
I like it that you always talking about horror stories and then say, oh, it's so beautiful and, beautifully written. And because, yeah, I share that feeling a lot of times that I really like it. And I wouldn't read horror if it wouldn't be beautiful in a way, if it wouldn't
make
me enjoying my life more. It doesn't have to be like really only showing me the evil side of the world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I speak on that for like 1 second?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's also one of like the guiding principles of what I write is the idea of dark awe, right? It's stumbling on like this vista of like this atmospheric, eerie thing that's like possibly incomprehensible, but it's still beautiful. And I think most of my favorite writers do something like that. Like Adrian Van Young has a short story collection called Midnight Self. And I reviewed it for the Southwest Review a while ago. And it was amazing. And he does a lot of this stuff that I love. But there's one story in it, and I can't remember the name, but it's a historical horror cosmic-y piece with zombies. So it's set in the Civil War. And like one of the main characters is fleeing from something. And they basically stumble into this cave system. And then they eventually get into this room where it's like opened up and there's like stalactites, stalagmites. There's like this weird thing happening. And there's a ton of these zombies that are all dressed in like Civil War garb. And there's like a person in a cage. And it's just this like hauntingly beautiful thing where like there's something like really disturbing going on. But it's done in such a beautiful way that you like have to pause for a moment. And you're like, wow, if that... My brain makes it into a painting, right? And like in my mind, that painting, I'm like, wow, that's phenomenal. Like the paintings I have behind me are kind of getting at that. Like there's this spooky one of like a houseboat with a church on it in the middle of like a haunted swamp. And that's just something I love. And it's something I'm always searching for. So yay, dark awe.
And if your camera's moving, sometimes it seems like the picture's moving, which is really spooky.
Oh, good.
Yeah, we did that. So I questioned you a lot. I mentioned that there will be a last question, which is usually about your future project, because we have this story collection that is really fresh, like a month ago or so, freshly out. But what can we expect next from you?
Yeah, I mean, I always have a number of short stories coming out. On March 21st, which is this Friday, I've got a flash fiction piece coming out in Flash Fiction Online. I think it's one of the best things I've written. It just came out of me and was just good. And I was just like, man, it's cosmic horror. It's in a future drowned world where people pray to these spirits of the drowned. And you have to kind of make pilgrimages to see them. It's super weird and I love it. So I have some other short stories coming out. I've got this blitz. Myself, Eric Raglan, and Tiffany Morris, we're doing this eco-horror, eco-weird, eco-dark fantasy split where I have I think it's a novella. It might be a novelette. I don't remember the exact length. But it's like a far future quest narrative about these people living in a climate-ravaged world where every living thing is kind of susceptible to this disease where if an infected person gets it, whenever their body touches other organic material, it kind of creates one life form. So people get stuck as these like monstrosities, and there's one area in this world that's safe and the characters have to quest to get there. But like it's in the future where there's no technology. So they basically just have like spears and they have to fend off these kind of monstrous beasts. And it's done in like a very fragmentary style. And I think it's one of the best things I've done, but it's super weird. Like there's a scene where there's this man who like somehow contacted a bunch of mice. So he's just got like his whole skin is just covered in mice. And it doesn't end well for that guy, but it's just real weird. And Again, hopefully there's some moments in there that are very beautiful and quiet and sad in certain ways. But it also gets at the idea of dark awe, where there's a lot of these like open landscape shots of this kind of futuristic, dark, deserty place. And I had a real good time writing it. So I think Eric's shooting to have that out maybe in the summer, maybe in the fall. I don't really know. I know that they're getting the cover made right now. So that's happening. My agent is putting out a novella of mine on sub pretty soon. I have a novel that is probably in the final stages of editing. So like once that's done, when that is done, my agent will start trying to put that out. The novella is about the local punk scene on Cape Cod and resurrection and ghosts and portals to hell. Again, real fun. And then the novel is about a cursed island off of Cape Cod. It's cosmic horror. It's about a writing retreat that happens there, and how things just go off the rails. And again, very fragmentary, very somewhere between literary and genre fiction. So we'll see how it goes. I feel very good about both of them. I feel like I've learned a lot over my years of writing, and hopefully people like it.
Yeah, let's wait and see.
Yeah.
That's cool. So thank you for your time and your engagement in my questions. And I'm glad you never called a question of mine interesting. Yeah, so have a nice day, and I'm looking forward to your next short stories and novellas, which will come out, and the novel, of course.
I really appreciate it. Like, thanks for having me on. It's just, you know, great talking to you about this stuff.
Yeah, thank you.